Esther chapter 5. Esther 5, beginning of verse 4. And Esther answered, if it seemed good unto the king, let the king and Haman come this day unto the banquet that I prepared for him. Then the king said, cause Haman to make haste, that he may do as Esther has said. So the king and Haman came to the banquet that Esther had prepared. And the king said unto Esther at the banquet of wine, what is thy petition? And it shall be granted thee. And what is thy request? Even to the half of the kingdom it shall be performed. Then answered Esther and said, my petition and my request is, if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my petition and to perform my request, let the king and Haman come to the banquet that I shall prepare for them, and I will do tomorrow as the king has said. There's a Jewish midrash or commentary on this part of Esther. And it informs us that this portion of Esther, from this portion of Esther, that God never leaves Israel in dire distress for more than 3 days. Now, as I noted before, this seems to be not only true, but is typical of the resurrection of Christ. So there's a case of Abraham. Remember, Abraham was told to offer up Isaac, which we're told finally finds his resolution on the third day. In Genesis 22:4, then on the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place afar off. Now, the account of him offering up his son is an account which Paul in Hebrews assures us typified the resurrection. Hebrews 11, verses 17 and following, by faith, Abraham, when he was tried, offered up Isaac. And he that had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said that in Isaac shall thy seed be called, accounting that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, from whence also he received him in a figure. So the account of Abram and Isaac, Isaac is a figure of the resurrection of Christ on the third day. Of course, there is the more famous case of Jonah, who spent 3 days and three nights in the belly of that great fish in Jonah 1:17. Now the Lord had prepared a great fish to swallow up Jonah, and Jonah was in the belly or the bowels of the fish 3 days and three nights. Now that account Christ himself owns as typical of his death, his burial, and his resurrection. So 3 days. Matthew 12:40, for as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the whale's belly, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. And thus on the third day then, Esther arises from fasting and prayer and goes into the throne room of Xerxes or Ahasuerus. Now you might ask, is this a type of the resurrection of the dead? Well, I think if you recall the threat and the level of threat of death that was leveled against anyone who would enter the throne room of the king without being summoned, there is reason to think that this, in fact, does play in to what we should understand here. 1936, archaeological excavations around Persepolis, which is the Persian city, that's what that means, was the capital of the Persian Empire during that period. It uncovered two bas reliefs, those carved stone pictures. One of which shows the king on his throne holding a long scepter and a guard standing just behind him with a very big axe. Now, the bas relief, they estimate, comes from this time when Ahasuerus would have been sitting upon the throne. And so, the threat was in fact real. It is in fact credible. And we know they had the means to do it from the archaeological data. But by entering it precisely the right time, as she did, providentially, Esther was spared the axe. And so she really is, in a sense, standing before the king, resurrected, just like Isaac, in a figure. I want you to consider Esther again. It's notable that in the book of Esther, she's the only character who has two names. Now, I think that this hints at her struggle between her private identity and its relation to her public character. With her move to stand before the king, Esther now will exhibit this heroic character which pushes her to the forefront of the rest of the book. I was reading somewhere that very often in an Old Testament class, they would ask students who were taking classes on Esther who the main figure of the book of Esther was. And about half of the people, I think they said, were sure that it was Esther, and the other half were as sure it was Mordecai. Well, however you would answer that question, from this point on, Esther becomes the central figure in the book of Esther. And this is reflected in the use of a royal title, queen. Now, Esther's mentioned nearly 40 times in the book of Esther. 10 chapters. The last one's not very long. She's mentioned nearly 40 times. Out of those, she's called queen 14 times. Of those usages, 13 of the 14 occur from the beginning of chapter 5 to the end of the book. So, 13 of the 14 begin when she enters the throne room, which I think indicates this. Her royal destiny was noted before this, but it's hidden until this. Now she's going to grow to fill the requirements of her royal destiny. What are the requirements? Well, she's a type of the church. And as such, she's moving from being a private believer to a public advocate for the true religion. And the only way she can do this is by obeying the word of the prophet of God, Mordecai. Now, I think it's important here, significant anyway, that she kisses or touches the scepter. She probably is kissing the scepter, but she's touching at least. Luther has noted that this is reminiscent of the gospel. Christ's scepter is that which by which he bears rule and sway over the nations in Psalm 2:9. So the idea is that when Esther is kissing or touching the scepter, she's showing a certain adoration rooted, as we're going to see, in her belief that the scepter or royal authority shall now be wielded on behalf of the people of God rather than against the people of God. And I think that it is more than just a touch. I think it's a kiss. Because in Scripture, a kiss, her kiss would be the kiss of the church, which is, as an established church, giving its blessing to the royal authority now being exercised to bless and defend the church. Now, on the third day, had the king, whose law, remember, was irrevocable, had he not extended the scepter, which is not only a symbol of his authority, but the extension of it was also a gracious thing. And had he not done this, a nation of the Jews would have died. So there is in this somewhat a type or a figure of Christ, because if he hadn't risen on the third day, and had the Father not accepted of his sacrifice, all of his people would have perished forever too. So I think we need to keep some of these things in mind as they're going on in the book of Esther. Now the king, the chief magistrate, has, for reasons unmentioned, shown at this point an uncommon degree of affection for the queen when she comes before him. He's even offered to give her up to half of the kingdom. He's going to give her whatever she wants, up to half of the kingdom, if that's her request. And so with that in mind, knowing that he's made this rather outlandish proposal, or this outlandish gesture, in a sense, Esther's reply is somewhat puzzling, because we know what she really needs to do. But what does she do? Well, let's look at that. That's the point of these verses, verses 4 through 8. And Esther answered, "If it seemed good unto the king, let the king and Haman come this day unto the banquet that I prepared for him." Now, the authorized version says Esther answered, but the Hebrew really uses the word amar. It means that she spoke. There is a verb that they could have used, but the verb that they use here is different from the verb which is strictly a verb meaning to answer. Now, that does come up later. I think the reason that we're just told she's speaking is that when she speaks at this point, she's not responding directly to his offer. Instead, it appears that she's speaking to him about something that she has previously designed, or perhaps someone else has helped her with this, but I suspect it comes out of her praying, as I want to get into in just a minute here. The point is, her response represents thought that had been given to the matter at hand before anyone had heard the king's response. This idea, "I'm going to give you up to half of the kingdom." So Esther hadn't come as one unsent without a message. Esther had the message of Mordecai. But it turns out she has more than that. She's coming with more than what Mordecai had asked her to bring. Now, why had she arisen on the third day and dressed herself in her royal garments and gone swiftly to the throne room as she did? Now, the picture we're given is that in the middle of this fast, three-day fast, the third day, she stops and gets up and goes. No indication the rest of the Jews have stopped any of this, but she does. And I think the answer is that she's moving as a woman who had received what the Puritans would have called a return of prayer. In other words, she's gained some sense of answer to her prayer, her petition. Including, and I believe from what follows, that this is included in her prayer, her answer to prayer, she's gained some extraordinary wisdom for an extraordinary task. Right, so she may not have all of the information in front of her as a result of praying, but she now has the assurance that she will have what she needs as she needs it going into this. So Esther now, I think, has not only a petition, but as a result of this prayer and fasting, she has a plan for presenting that petition. And that's important. Because the plan was born of prayer and fasting. And it was born of prayer and fasting not only on her part, but on the part of all of those who were taken up in this concern for Haman's decree against the Jews. And Esther answered, "If it seemed good unto the king." Now, that phrase in Hebrew means idiomatically more like, if it is good in thy judgment, or if it's good according to thy pleasure. Esther, notice, she begins her speaking with an appeal to the goodwill of the king. He's already given her an indication of this, and in demonstrating a forwardness and a desire to accommodate the wishes of the king, if she hadn't planned on doing this before, and I think she probably had, nonetheless, this is a good time to do it. So in so doing, as I pointed out last time, when the king made that overture to the queen, it was a gesture of affection to her, but also a gesture of trust in her. And Esther here is actually reciprocating this affection and trust. She's saying, by responding in this way, she's saying she accepts his gesture, and she also wishes him to understand that his trust in her is not misplaced. She's a trustworthy person. And by saying, "if it seemed good unto the king," she's actually, I think, making it very clear that she is not prepared to press for any demand beyond what the king finds to be reasonable or within the range of desires that he is willing to fulfill. In other words, she wants him to know that though he's proffered up to half of the kingdom, she is not going to be looking to get all of that. If this were divorce court, his attorneys would be very happy. Esther answered, "If it seemed good unto the king, let the king and Haman come this day unto the banquet." Here, I think, is where Esther's strategy starts to get very puzzling. Mordecai has told her what? Go into the throne room, present a petition for the lives of the Jews. She now has the king's attention, his goodwill, his expressions of devotion and trust. And rather than ask him what she's really there to ask, what she asks is, she wants to have a banquet, feast. Now, the particular kind of feast that she's asking the king about is the kind of feast that is characterized at the end of it by the drinking of a lot of wine, and we'll see that in a later verse. But it's even stranger than this. That may not be quite so strange, but it's a little strange. And consider the book of Esther. Last time there was all this feasting, it brought trouble. It brought the very trouble that the children of Israel are facing now. It's brought them to this point. But now she wants a feast, and she only wants to have two people present, the king and Haman, who is his grand vizier, his chief advisor, his chief courtier. Now, it's very possible that pairing these two people together, to be present together, that might have made the king suspicious or perhaps even a bit jealous. You know, why me and him? You know, it's not, if you think about it this way, It's not so odd if it were going to be a general party and all kinds of people were coming and Haman showed up. But when you're the queen and you're asking for a banquet, a specific kind of banquet, and you only want two people there, the king was probably saying, well, I know why she wants me there, but why does she want him there? Why was Haman being called? Now, the rabbis suggest here that it might be to excite jealousy in the king, and that the particularly what they suspect is he would have feared that Haman desired the queen and would kill him in order to have her. Now, I think that they get this idea actually from later in the book, and they're importing it back. It's possible. I'm not going to say that this is an unwarranted thought. In light of later events, it's very possible that the king is having this kind of thought, but it certainly is going to cause her, or going to cause him, I should say, to have some odd thoughts about the matter. You know, why him? Well, I understand me, but why him? You know, I'm the one granting the request, I understand me. But there's another thing that the rabbis have pointed out, and that is by inviting only Haman. One thing that Esther is certainly going to do is cause more envy among the other courtiers. When you are Haman, your position is never secure, by the way. Everyone is gunning for you. Everybody wants your spot. You know, it's the top slot next to the king. So, the other courtiers were probably already cautious about him. But by inviting him and not them, that's going to knock the legs out of any support that Haman might have had when he runs afoul of the king later on. So by doing this, she's actually doing something very smart. She's creating a condition, an environment of suspicion. It's going to work in her favor and ultimately in favor of the Jewish people. Now, there are a lot of commentators who've seen this interposing of a banquet here before offering the petition as a delaying tactic on the part of Esther. And a lot of them suppose that she's doing this because in some sense she's unsure of her position, unsure of the reaction of the king, unsure of the outcome. And she's just trying to buy more time. Other commentators have said that this is really just a sort of a literary flourish designed to create a little bit more suspense in the story, to build the tension. And I agree, it's there to build tension. But I don't think it's just literary tension. So I think it's much better to see that Esther is moving with deliberation and wisdom. And what might seem to be unnecessary delays are in reality deliberate strategies for creating tension in the king regarding Esther's request, but also creating that space where Haman is going to swell with the pride that will cause him to mess up and will ultimately be part of the cause anyway, leading to his ultimate downfall. So Esther's strategy is designed to bring the king to a height of anticipation while at the same time allowing Haman to prepare to expose himself for what he really is, a grasping man motivated by base self-interest. Having Haman here with the king at this banquet would show Haman the favorability with which the king viewed her. And that, in turn, would undermine his confidence in any response that he might try to give when he hears what Esther's petition will be. So having Haman with the king when she made the petition is going to ensure that Esther is cutting off an avenue. It would have been a tactical error not to do this. By having Haman there, she's not leaving the king an excuse to say, I have to go talk to him about this first. He's there. He knows the dynamic, the chemistry. And neither one is going to have any time to think about that petition. It's going to be out on the table. All the information will be presented. And they're going to have to deal with it raw, without a possibility of a private conference. Or at least it's going to lessen the likelihood of private conference where Haman would try to undermine her request to the king. Now it's notable, actually, in this clause of the verse. If you remember, when we started Esther, I pointed out that that God is never mentioned. But in Hebrew, in this clause, the first four letters of the first four words in Hebrew, the words which are translated in English, let the king and Haman come this day, they actually spell out the sacred name of God, which the Jews never pronounce. The name that they say Hashem or Adonai. In the Masoretic text, this interesting thing does not go unnoticed. The letters are actually made more prominent there to let you know that somebody noticed this, that it's sort of like an acrostic spelling out the sacred name of God. Now, whether it's intentional or not is a point that's been debated. But I find it interesting that the name of God does make this obscure appearance, at least in this fashion, at the very point at which this story begins to shift toward the redemption of Israel. Just a side note. It would seem good unto the king, let the king and Haman come this day unto the banquet that I have prepared for him. So Esther wishes their attendance not at any old banquet, but she's got a particular banquet in mind. It's the one that she has specifically prepared for him. And that means that prior to coming before the king, she'd already made some kind of preparation. You don't announce this banquet and try to usher them into a banquet without having a little bit of time to prepare. Right? Think about how long it takes you to prepare food just for a normal meal. This is going to be a banquet. But she says she's prepared this banquet for him. Now, in context, she's talking to Ahasuerus. So she must be speaking of Haman. The verb actually means the banquet was being given for him, which means it must have been, what she's saying is, this is a banquet on behalf of Haman. So that's her explanation as to why. But this still doesn't answer any of his questions, does it? Why she's come before him. Why would she do what she's done with all that risk in order to have a banquet for Haman? None of this really makes sense. So the notion that she'd prepared a banquet especially for Haman must have been an additional reason for the king to wonder at her intention. If his interest was piqued before this, much more so now. In fact, much of the point of having this banquet was, as I've indicated, prepared for Haman. It would not be, however, what he in his pride of heart envisioned. Right? It is actually for him. He's thinking this is a good thing, but we know that it's really not. So, verse 5, then the king said, cause Haman to make haste, that he may do as Esther has said. So the king and Haman came to the banquet that Esther had prepared. The king said, once again, he heard Esther's request for a banquet. The king responds. Again, as I noted earlier, the verb used here again is not the one for making a direct reply to her. And here it's very clear why he's not making a direct reply, because from the context we see, he's speaking to those who are around him. The king said, then the king said, cause Haman to make haste. So he's not answering Esther. And he doesn't give her a direct answer. In answer to her, what he does is he turns to his court attendants and he says to them, go and fetch Haman. And do it quickly. There's a verb. The verb is imperative here. Because Ahasuerus is not merely suggesting that things get moving. He wants them to move quickly. I don't know whether he's worried about the food getting cold, but he certainly wants to know why she is having this banquet and what she is up to. So he wants to get to the banquet as hastily as he can. And the very fact that the king's desire to hasten the event, I think, indicates here to us that what she's doing has had its effect. He's become very curious. So his hopes to discover the cause of Esther coming before him at this point has assumed this heightened proportion. And the king said, cause Haman to make haste, that he may do as Esther has said. Now, again, in this clause, we have a hint already of the king's stance toward Esther. Right? We know from what was said before that he's favorable in his disposition. But here he's actually commanding the hastening of Haman in order to do what Esther has said she wanted done. Now, for just a moment, I want you to consider this. Prior to this time, Haman was one of only a handful of people who was actually allowed access to the king without a royal summons. Okay, when Esther tells Mordecai that nobody could go before the king without a summons, without an invitation, she is not talking about 5 or 6 people. Haman is one of them. Okay, there are 5 or 6 people who are always allowed to be before the king when he's doing all of this. So Haman, by reason of his position, had been granted full and free access, something which was denied to even the queen herself. And yet this freedom of access, which he had, by reason of her approach to the throne, has now become a matter of compulsion. Before, he could come and go as he saw fit. Now, because of what she said, he has to come. And we can already see Haman losing what control he might have had before this. And I think that this loss of control and power that's being foreshadowed here is actually inviting us to compare Haman to Vashti, who was also commanded to come to a feast earlier in the book of Esther. And although we know that Haman, unlike Vashti, Haman's going to come, the idea that he is commanded to come to a feast, given the way the book of Esther begins, is, I think, designed to give us a sense of foreboding. After all, last time somebody was commanded to come to a feast, it didn't end well for the person who was summoned. Right? And of course, if we've read the whole book of Esther, we already know it's not going to end well in the case of Haman either. So I think it's deliberate that this is going on. We're being given this hint that the trajectory of power is changing. Then the king said, "Cause Haman to make haste that he may do as Esther has said." So the king and Haman came to the banquet that Esther had prepared. So it came to pass, both the king and Esther, or excuse me, the king and Haman came to the banquet that Esther has made. Not only is Esther prepared or given it, which we should understand to be implied for Haman, she's given it for Haman, but she's also issued the request, which the king has made a command for Haman to come. So whether or not Haman realizes it or not, whether or not he realizes it, even though he's a wicked pagan priest, he's now being directly commanded by the influences of Esther, and through her, the church and people of God. Think about that. Okay, already, the church and people of God are exerting an influence over Haman, even though he doesn't yet get it. And that means that already his grasp on power was weakened and weakening. Now that's what we should know from this, and yet such was the pride of Haman, as we're going to see, that he could not see anything of the reversal that was coming his way in all of this. It's true, Esther's throwing a banquet for him, but it's not in his honor. This is a banquet that would echo the observations we see the psalmist has of the wicked in Psalm 73. "Surely thou didst set them in slippery places. Thou cast them down into destruction. How are they brought into desolation as in a moment? They are utterly consumed with terrors. As a dream when one awakeneth, so, O Lord, when thou awakest, thou shalt despise their image." Now that's the end of the psalmist's observations. But if you remember at the beginning of Psalm 73, the psalmist says, "When I beheld the prosperity of the wicked, my foot well nigh slipped. I almost fell." Why are they being blessed, seemingly, when I'm the one who's obedient, when I'm the one who is trying to obey God, and it seems like the wicked are always prospering? Well, in verse 17, before he says, "I see that you're setting them in slippery places," he says, "Then I went to the sanctuary of my God." And so I want to suggest that reading the book of Esther is, in a sense, allowing us to see things from the perspective of the sanctuary of God. So that, as the psalmist says, we must needs do the same. Look at it from that perspective. We're going to understand the end of the wicked. Haman is being set up for a bigger fall. Haman is being fattened for the slaughter. Now, it's a sad truth, and it's a hard truth about the wicked. Unbelievers actually don't have real friendships. They can't. That may sound like a harsh judgment, but to the extent that they form genuine bonds, those bonds can never rise above this world, or if they do, it is only against the true religion and people of God. Remember Herod and Pilate, who had been at enmity, but they became friends in order to crucify Christ. They're friends for a day. So Esther's bringing together two men who, really, the only reason they have anything in common is they share an animosity toward Israel. But when Ahasuerus' affections are turned against Haman, when he wants, the love that he once had to his wicked friend changes, which is based upon a shared hatred of the people of God, that affection that he has, rooted in a common hatred of the people of God, that is going to become the pretext for his downfall and execution. So the very area where Haman and the king right now are bonding will become the very area, because of what Esther's doing, that will give the king the rationale for casting down Haman and destroying him. And that's really what the friendship of the wicked always looks like. It's really just an accommodation for a time until one gets the upper hand of the other. Now, by arranging for these two men to be together when this happens, Esther's actually ensuring the return of mutual hatred. And that, in turn, is going to ensure Haman's demise. Because she's cut him off from any hope from any of the other courtiers by inviting him alone. And when this mutual fondness or friendship is turned to hatred again, nobody's going to dare cross the king to save Haman. So in due time, his foot shall slide. The king said unto Esther at the banquet of wine, "What is thy petition? And it shall be granted thee. And what is thy request? Even to the half of the kingdom it shall be performed." The king said unto Esther at the banquet of wine, "The king and Haman were told of now come to the banquet, the feast. Moreover, they've reached that portion or point in the banquet when it was time to increase the drinking of wine. And as the wine flowed, the idea was the senses of these men would leave themselves and it would be easier probably to get them to act like complete morons and destroy themselves. But as the wine flowed, the king's spirits rose as well. And he'd been eager to hear more from the queen. And so he wants to know what she sought. But it seems he'd been restrained from his enthusiasm until late into this banquet, when they began to give attention to the drinking of wine. So the king is now once more ready to pursue his petition, his inquiries, I should say. He says, "What is thy petition?" Now, I don't think I noted this so much earlier, but the word petition, I did note this, it connotes a demand, but there's a presumption of importunity in Esther's entrance earlier in the day. Okay, the king is looking at her now as he's drinking this wine, and he says, "What is this request which made you breach protocol? What kind of request would this be that would make you risk your life coming into my throne room unannounced like that?" And we all know we're here for some reason beyond this banquet. And surely he's indicating it's time to reveal the matter. After all, if it was pressing enough that you couldn't wait to ask and receive a royal summons to come to my court, it seems like we should move on and get this out of the way now. "What is thy petition? And it shall be granted thee." And unless the king's question seemed to be too ominous, he quickly adds his promise, "I will give it thee. I will grant it. Just tell me what it is that drove you to take such a rash course of action." Just tell me. "Whatever it is, I'm pleased to grant the petition." Now, the Hebrew word for petition here can also mean sacrifice. And in light of the promise that he makes to her, he's extended a promise of an almost sacrificial scale. Up to half of my kingdom. What is thy petition? It shall be granted. What is thy request? Or what is thy wish or desire? Again, the king here recognizes she's been driven by some deep personal reason. And the king wants to know this too. He'd love to know this as well. Now, there is a sense in which he's demanding, but we need to understand his demeanor toward her is anything but hostile. He's trying to get her to reveal the rationale for coming boldly into his throne room. And again, he reiterates, even to the half of the kingdom it shall be performed. That's a pretty large promise. By repeating it, he's telling her he holds her in high esteem. He has great affection for her. He's going to give her everything, anything she desires or wishes, up to half the kingdom. Now, what's so special about these words? These are the words the king used when she came before him initially, right? In fact, the words the king's using here are nearly identical at several key points to what he said earlier in the throne room. Why repeat this here? Well, I think there's one very important difference with these words now. And that is, these words are being said by the king to Esther in front of none other than Haman. And as Haman heard these words, he must have known that he could do nothing against the queen directly without incurring the wrath of the king, who he now knows, obviously, is quite fond of her. In fact, he's been openly expressing his affection for her and his trust in her. But you know, it's very interesting. Human nature is an interesting thing. Corrupt human nature as well. Haman is not yet even aware that he's facing a problem. Now, this is a pig being fattened for slaughter. And he is absolutely unaware that behind the next door, his head is going to be cut off. You know, such is his sense of self-worth, such is his swelling pride, that he does not detect what's coming for him or what's coming for his plan. For the moment, all he sees is himself as one who is so highly esteemed that he, among all the courtiers, is privy to the intimacy of the king's relation with the queen. And because he doesn't know that she's a Jewess, of course, he's not going to suspect anything regarding his plan to destroy the Jews. So in verse 7, then answered Esther and said, "My petition and my request is." And there you go. There's that Hebrew word that is most properly the word for the word answer. Then answered Esther. Esther is making a direct response now to Ahasuerus' questions and request of her. Now keep in mind, in all of this, Haman remains a passive observer. He doesn't say a word, does he, in all of this? What's unfolding for his benefit is something over which he has no control. In Esther's response to the king, we have a good indication that she's demonstrating the same affectionate courtesy and deference which he had been quick to yield to her. And her appearance in faith has renewed and encouraged his interest in her. She seems intent on taking full advantage of his goodwill now, She wants to take advantage of this goodwill, this favorable demeanor toward her for the cause of God and truth. That's what she's trying to do at this point. Then answered Esther and said, "My petition and my request is." In answer, she refers to the fact that she does have something to ask to the king. It's an entreaty. It's an official. It's of an official nature. Now, what's notable is, and you can see this in the English, she's actually using the same words to describe her reason for coming as the king has used, petition and request. Now, why is she doing that? In the world of negotiations, what she's doing is mirroring the person whom she's seeking to gain access, right? She's trying to mirror get what she desires. So she's letting him know, by doing this, she's letting him know she's heard him and that she intends to address his questions to her. She's trying to give him some assurance here that she's not just trying to dodge everything. By doing this, she's demonstrating her goodwill and suggesting that there's some common ground in her approach to him. And yet, Esther's not quite ready yet to reveal her reason for intruding into the throne room unannounced and unsummoned as she did. Her plan isn't fully executed. There's a bit more preparation as she's stretching the king's curiosity, stretching his willingness to grant her relief, as well as creating room for Haman to slip up, to make a mistake before the king. Remember that Esther is careful precisely because she's prayed through the matter. She is increasingly certain of the outcome and assured of the course of her action as she moves forward, because her faith is being confirmed again and again by a number of very improbable twists and turns of events, each of which favors the deliverance and redemption of Israel, the church. But then answered Esther and said, "My petition and my request is," verse 8, "if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my petition and to perform my request, let the king and Haman come to the banquet that I shall prepare for them, and I will do tomorrow as the king has said." If I found favor in the sight of the king. Esther is now demonstrating she understands the nature and the character of her husband. What is she doing? She's appealing to his love for her. And she's exercising his patience all at the same time. And by doing it this way, what she is doing is she's exciting in him a desire to be kinder still to her. She's encouraging him to be even more gracious toward her. You see, it's often the wisest thing you can do to seek to get some small yeses out of someone before you can get the big ones. To ignite in them a sense of goodwill toward you. Because once people have shown an inclination to be kind toward you, very often they're moved more easily to greater acts of kindness. Asking for little favors very often is the best route to getting big favors. And Esther understands this. So a seemingly small thing, like finding favor in the eye of another, is being leveraged here to bigger and more important goals. Esther knows that Ahasuerus loves her, that he's favorable toward her, that he's kindly affectionated with respect to her. And thus, she has another small request. I found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my petition. And once more, she acknowledges she depends upon the king to grant or withhold her petition. Notice, however, she uses the same word. And she hangs its issue on the good pleasure of the king. Now, this petition will not be the same one she was charged by Mordecai to make. This petition, instead, is meant to elicit more kindness rather than a reversal of the terrible decree of Haman at this point. And yet, the word in Hebrew, petition, always does signify asking or demanding something tangible and objective. And so that's exactly what she's doing. She's asking for something tangible and objective. If it please the king to grant my petition and to perform my request. Again, she mirrors the words of the king. A request, by the way, in Hebrew, is in contrast to a petition, signifies something more intangible and more subjective. So it signifies the wish or the heart's desire. Now she notes that by granting the tangible, he also will be doing what he can to fulfill her innermost wishes. If I found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleased the king to grant my petition and to perform my request, let the king and Haman come to the banquet that I should prepare for them. It's almost as if she's saying, look, this has been such an enjoyable time. Why let the moment pass? Let there be another banquet tomorrow. Let me continue to prepare. This time, she says, for both the king and Haman. So this is going to excite the king's desire to know. It would also seem to prove her respect for Haman. Right? She not only is going to excite his desire, but what she's doing is going to make Haman think, ah, she really does like me. Now, among the rabbis, there was some thought that Haman knew at least a bit of Esther's care for Mordecai. He knew by this time that there was some sort of a tie between them. And if that's the case, coming to this first banquet, Haman might have been a little apprehensive. But by the end of this first banquet, he is slipping quietly into daydreaming now about the security of his position. We're going to see that in the following verses. We do see that. And whatever questions he might have had, whatever reservations might have been in him, now, again, as we're going to see, he thinks Esther is altogether on his side in any contest. He thinks he's in a good place. For him, probably as it is for a lot of people who try to judge of their condition by providence rather than by the word of God, this is going to be very much bound to confirm the casting of the lots, right? He's going to think, well, that really worked. That was effectual. He must have chosen the right day. Everything from Haman's point of view seems to be going the right way now. For the moment, Haman would have cause to think that the fates had smiled upon his endeavor to destroy the Jews. Just for a moment. But he couldn't have been more wrong, could he? Anyway, Esther continues, and I will do tomorrow as the king has said. So, if the king will allow one more banquet, she concludes by assuring the king, should he grant that petition, that tangible, objective thing, that she's not going to continue to drag out his inquiry, she's not going to continue to play him. She promises it tomorrow. She's permitted to host another banquet. She's going to make her petition request known even as the king has asked. I just want to conclude by noting here that Esther's actions show us the confidence that comes from careful praying over a situation. She's joined fasting to prayer. And she's mortified the flesh. And the result is that she moves with a certain freedom. She's moving freely in all of this. Notice that. She's the one moving freely. But the king, and even more so Haman, are falling under greater and greater constraint in what's happening. And the queen, who began this under the greatest constraint, she wasn't even allowed to come unsummoned, she now seems to be calling all the shots. She now is the one who actually is exhibiting the most freedom. And that's because she's conducting herself through a series of providences prayerfully. You know, if she weren't doing so, these providences would be too dense to discern. But she is just waltzing through all of this with hardly a problem or hardly giving a sense that there is an issue. We have in the book of Esther here a simple narrative. We have a woman completely unarmed against two men who have, for all intents and purposes, all the power in the world. And these are complicated men. But through the power of God, she is actually able to discern and parse the intricacies of human nature here. And through the guidance of God, she is made to prosper far beyond anything that she could have ever calculated or ever even surmised. As we reach what is a crescendo in the building tension of the story in the book of Esther, Esther is brought to a reckoning. Tomorrow, now, in verse 8, we know, she has to make her petition and request known. And so they're only one night away from the next banquet, wherein everything has to be revealed. And once more, as we're going to see, once more, events will transpire which will change the mind and influence the king in an even greater proportion and incline him to a greater favorability that will conceal within it the redemption of the Jews. And perhaps as Esther prepared for this final banquet, she spent the night weeping before the Lord for herself and for her people. I suspect that's likely. Because the scripture tells us, the psalmist tells us, that weeping may endure for a night, but joy cometh in the morning. And that's exactly what we're going to see that happens before the next banquet. And that is another link in a chain of inextricable providences that are the great miracle of redemption in the book of Esther. Amen.